This podcast is brought to you by the National Trust of South Australia. It's about local people and places. The first series comes from Gawler. Thanks for joining us on Our Town. Let's dive in.
We are speaking with Marilyn Tucker from the National Trust Museum in Gawler. She's telling us about some little-known aspects of Gawler's industry in the 1950s through to the 1970s. Who has ever heard of Timer Fashions? Marilyn's going to tell us.
My name's Marilyn Tucker, and I'm a member of the Gawler branch of the National Trust of South Australia. And I'm going to tell you a story about the industry known as Timer Fashions. The beginning of Timer. Some years ago, our branch recognised that while we had a number of stories of the early days of Gawler, there was little that we could add due to the passage of time. So we decided to investigate some more contemporary stories. That is, things that had happened in the living memory of some of our local residents. Two ideas sprang to mind, one being the many stories to be found in our migrant hostel of the 1940s and 50s. This has been a most successful project, culminating in a written history from many of those who started their lives in Australia living in the hostel. Secondly, we embarked on the story of one of the larger businesses to operate in Gawler, Timer Fashions. During the 19th century, we had large foundries in Gawler, manufacturing factories, which employed up to 1,500 men. But in the 20th century, Timer was different. It employed women. In our museum, we have a very large photograph of the interior of the Timer factory. It shows rows and rows of women seated at sewing machines in what today would be viewed as something from the sweatshops of Bangladesh or Indonesia. But it was 1950s Gawler, South Australia. How did this happen? In these two talks, I'll tell you firstly about the business and then I'll tell you about some of the people who worked there. Start with the business. Well, it had its origins in a small business started by Joe Jacobs in the 1920s. He set his business up in Murray Street, the main street in Gawler, where he employed initially untrained women to do simple machine sewing. They made nursery squares or nappies, aprons and pyjamas. With training, the workers developed into making dresses and skirts. The business continued on during the hard times of the Depression. With the start of the Second World War, manufacturers were required to make military uniforms. Joe, however, was offered a chance to become an inspector of such establishments. Surprisingly, despite the war, the federal government implemented a decentralisation policy in 1942 and to encourage the textile industry to participate, offered licences to import fabric, something which is puzzling given that the fabrics had to travel through oceans at war. The Meyer Emporium approached Joe to set up a clothing factory in Gawler with a view to an exclusive deal for children's clothes. Meyer purchased the existing plant and Joe was appointed the manager. Joe carried this out while still being a factory inspector. Again, the business was operating from the main street. It employed 20 machinists, growing to 60 within 3 years. The business was very profitable, so together with the directors of Meyer, Joe established a company called Gawler Manufacturing Company Limited. The business grew and consequently purchased the old Fotheringham's brewery, and a new factory was built on the site, incorporating the existing cellar. This was later used as a plant room for the generation of steam and to house a standby generator for power. Power failures were frequent in that era. The business flourished and garments were made to cover all ages under the Timer brand, such as day timer, school timer, sports timer. Because of this success, the company changed its name to Timer Fashions Limited. I haven't as yet discovered the origins of the name Timer. The garments were sold all over Australia. Export orders were sought without much success. More capital was needed, so a public company was floated on the Adelaide Stock Exchange in the early 1950s. This company was called Adelaide Holdings Limited. An extension was built onto the factory to hold the growing business, which employed about 300 people, using 500,000 yards of imported fabric a year, which represents about 250,000 garments. Was the biggest clothing manufacturer in Australia during the 1950s and 1960s. Joe retired from the business early in the 1970s and his son Keith took a larger role. The business became less profitable with the increase in imported garments into Australia during the 1970s, resulting from the reductions of import tariffs. A Sydney businessman took over the company on the exchange and wound up its clothing manufacturing activities to use the company as a vehicle for another business. The plant in Gawler was sold to a local employee of Tyma and he continued manufacturing in Gawler into the 1990s. He did contract work for designers including George Gross and Harry Hu.
This podcast is brought to you by the National Trust of South Australia.
The second half of this talk is about the workers and their experiences. Many questions arose during our research, such as how were the garments designed? Who was the designer? It seems the business largely copied from garments seen in stores along Rundle Street, or in magazines, or even being worn by passers-by. There is a report in the Advertiser of August 1959. It was a puff piece. We would call it advertorial today. It was not an investigative report. It describes the design process carried out by Mrs. Green, the workroom manager, and three other women described as designers, really those who created the patterns from which the garments were made. Very skilled work in its own right, but not created from imagination. They perused fashion magazines from Europe and the USA. Garments were bought and taken apart, including garments flown from the USA. From these sources, a new garment emerged and was made and refined before going into production. Joe was reported in this article as saying that you have to be fast in fashion and no doubt very inventive. All garments were made to fill orders. They were not made on speculation. A great effort was put into ensuring every garment was inspected before it left the factory. One of the employees we interviewed reported that if a garment didn't pass the test, it was thrown down a well in the grounds. They did not operate a seconds outlet at that time. Production was to meet the needs of Myers primarily, but was sold throughout other outlets. They were largely simple items made to a low price point, not aspirational or glamorous like Proactin or Adele Weiss of the 1960s and 70s. They were purchased by working girls for wearing to work and for weekends. Evening wear was also at the lower end of the market. One big seller was hot pants. Sadly, we don't have any to show you, but if you ever see any in an op shop, let us know. Attempts were made to move the garments up market during the 1970s, obviously to fill the gap in the market left by the cheap imports. To this end, more sophisticated garments were produced and large advertisements were placed in magazines like Vogue Australia using well-known and no doubt expensive models of the day, such as Tanya Verstack, a Miss Australia of the era. Who were the workers? They were local girls. Some even travelled from Kabunda and Udunda on the train each morning. Many of the workers were residents of the migrant hostel in Williston. They walked to work or rode bikes, like the girls who left school one day and started at Tyma the next. After the city of Elizabeth was established, many travelled from there each day. Train timetables were paired with the needs of these workers in mind because the business was seen by the state government as important. This was a comment made to us by one of the employees. Girls were encouraged to choose a career that will be an asset to you through life. A quote from a brochure to encourage new staff to join Tyma. We have interviewed many of the employees. One interview was given by Pauline Davis, and she, like the others, spoke of her working life, which began in her case when she was 14 years old in January 1954. Her starting salary was £3.17.6, about $7.75. That was her weekly salary. And she started by removing stray threads and fabric dags. She knew this was a humble job, but it was important to the money-back guarantee company policy. She advanced through the ranks, eventually becoming a charge hand, in essence the foreman of an operation. There were six in total. The work was repetitive and boring, but everyone took pride in doing a good job. As people progressed through the business, they specialised in different aspects of the manufacture, like making collars or setting sleeves into a garment at the rate of 100 pairs per hour, a truly amazing achievement. Another worker reported making dozens of cuffs for little boys' dress shirts. Physical attributes often determined the task, like in the case of a cutter, who needed to be tall and strong, to lean over the large layout tables and manage thick piles of fabric, where multi-pieces were cut at one time. This job was done mainly by the few males who worked there. They all worked one shift from 8:30 a.m. to 4:45, 5 days a week, with occasional overtime in the evening and maybe a few hours on Saturday mornings at peak times at the beginning of a new season. Holiday leave was 3 weeks at Christmas for everyone. Pauline worked there until 1976 when the factory closed. Another worker we spoke to joined in 1944, one of the first 14 staff members. Her salary was £3.15 or $7.50. She had undertaken a dressmaking course at the local adult education centre and started with schools which she developed and quickly became a charge hand, responsible for overseeing the work of others and their training. She told us of the difficulties in working through the agent system, which sold the garments. She referred to a range of dresses made from tulle, a linen-like fabric, which had a matching coloured trim of lace. She did the dyeing and knew of the problems, so requested only the successful matches would be sold. This message did not get through, and garments were ordered and sold in the mismatched colours. This, she felt, did not meet Timer's high standards. Eileen said that she, like many others, did not buy Timer garments because they made their own clothes at home. Waste was kept to a minimum. One way it was explained to us by one of our branch members, who as a child had access to the fabric scraps. They were stored in the garage of our member's aunt, who lived next to the factory. As a treat, she was allowed to climb into the heaps and fossick for larger pieces of fabric, which she might make into clothes. The stored fabrics were destined for use as mattress filling once they were shredded. Accidents did happen, but rarely. They were mainly needle injuries, although we have had report of one accident, told of a finger being thrown into the bin after an accident with a round electric cutting knife. There was no microsurgery then. All accidents were attended to at the local hospital. One young girl caught her long blonde hair in a knife mechanism. This was simply solved. They cut off her hair, so she now had short blonde hair. Workers reported that it was a happy place to work, despite the fear of Mrs. Green. When her clacking heels were heard approaching down the floor, all heads were bent down working. There were no reports of industrial action, although that was not uncommon in a largely female workforce. Only about six men worked there during the peak times. With the closing of the factory, the workers moved on to other jobs. Some of the more experienced, like Eileen, continued with Colin Teal, who had purchased the plant. In the National Trust Museum, we have a collection of Timer garments, many acquired by op shops. We're always looking for more, so if you see any with a distinctive Timer label, please contact us. We must acknowledge the source of much of our information. We've gained written and verbal information from Keith Jacobs, verbal information from Colin Teal, who was the chief cutter and purchaser of the plant in the late 70s. We gained verbal information from numerous employees, especially Pauline Davids and Eileen Holmes, used here. There were articles in the newspapers, including The Advertiser. It was a staff newsletter produced by Meyer. We also have publicity from Time of Fashion. The early research for this project was done by Mike and Joan Dennis.
You have been listening to a podcast from the National Trust of South Australia. To find out more, visit us at one of our local heritage places or online at nationaltrust.org.au/essay.